You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast. Okay, so this is Chris Webster.
And this is Paul Zimmerman.
And we are actually sitting on the National Mall in front of the American Museum of Natural History.
And the castle.
And the Smithsonian Castle, which, being my first time to Washington, D.C., I didn't even know there was a thing called the Smithsonian Castle.
Yeah, we come down here. My sister lives up in Arlington, so we're down here every Christmas time. And used to come down with the kids all the time to ride on that carousel right across from us.
Nice, nice.
And go to the museums, obviously.
Museums, and that's what we're going to talk about. We've got, just to place people here, we've got the Washington Monument on our right. We've got the nation's capital on our left. I got Air and Space up and to the left here. That's the Hirshhorn, right?
I think so.
I think that's the Hirshhorn, and there's the sculpture garden back here to the left.
We've got the Natural History Museum directly behind us, the American History Museum behind and to the right.
Yeah. The new African-American Culture Museum is down there by the monument.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. I didn't have tickets. Did you?
I didn't have tickets either.
I didn't know that we needed tickets. I found out. I told my wife yesterday, I think I'll go see that. She said, oh, you got tickets? I was like, I what?
Yeah, we found that out not too long before we left, and I was like, you know what? I've never been down here. There's plenty of stuff we can see that we don't need tickets for right now.
Yeah.
Let's just kind of cover some of the highlights, and that's what we've been doing. So that's what we're going to talk about, though, is museums. And I guess, you know, we're just going to get into a conversation about this, and maybe a little later a conversation about what museums could be in the future. So I'll kick it off with this being my first time. You know, I've obviously been to museums before, but my first time down here at the Smithsonian Museums. And so, like I said, we've been to Air and Space, Natural History, just a little bit of it, the American Museum of History. Is that, yeah.
The Museum of American History. I was over at the Museum of Native American History.
That's right. Okay.
American Indian Museum.
American Indian Museum.
And yep. I'm going to go over to the Freer Sackler Galleries afterwards to go check out their Islamic collections.
Right. And we hit some of the other kind of big things you really need to do occasionally when you come here. We did a tour of the White House. We tried to do the Capitol, but you know, you have to sign up on your congressman's website for the White House or the Capitol, and you have to get tickets, and then they let you know 2 weeks out whether or not you actually got it.
Uh-huh.
We never even got contacted with the Capitol. But we got contacted about a month ago by the White House, the people that do that said, yeah, here's your time and blah, 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 all that stuff. You got to bring your little ticket and things. Anyway, and we also did we also walked up to Library of Congress. And I went through I think there's three buildings. We went through the main building right there, the Jefferson Building, I think it's called, uh-huh. The one with the big dome on it. So I mentioned that because those are all museums in their own right, really.
Yeah.
They're just done a different way. And, I mean, they have exhibits. There's exhibits in the Library of Congress, which I didn't even know that. I actually expected it to be a big library with a reading room. But there's actually
exhibits
in there.
You're just going to go through the stacks and find a carol and sit down and read for a bit?
I mean, it was just going to look, you know? I still don't know the answer to this question. What kind of book, how does a book get into, like in 2017, almost 2018, how do new books get into the Library of Congress? Like, I wrote a book 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That book's not sitting on a shelf in the Library of Congress. There would be not enough space for all the books that are written every year.
Right.
So how does a book get into the Library of Congress to actually physically be on the shelves? Or is it all older stuff?
Well, it's not all older stuff. New things do enter, but I don't know. I've heard the answer before, and I honestly can't.
I don't know the answer. Yeah. I mean, there was a small part of me that was curious, wondering, is my book sitting on a shelf at the Library of Congress? There was a tiny little fraction in my brain that was like, could that be true? I know it's not, but I know it's listed in there somewhere in some computer archive.
It's got to be.
Yeah, because this guy has an ISBN number.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's listed in there somewhere. But anyway, so museums. I've had a huge problem with museums in the past, because most of the museums I've seen in my life, let's face it, most of the museums everyone sees in their lives are probably smaller museums, less fancy. Well, you live in New York, so maybe all the museums
you see
are world class. But most of the time, I'm seeing like a small local museum or something like that, you know, and it's just a small affair. They're highlighting some stuff for the region.
Some little municipal things.
Yeah, totally.
Private museums, something like that.
Exactly. Yeah, really small things, something for a small town. It's a historical society or something mm-hmm. like that. And 9 times out of 10, they're displaying stuff the way I think like an art museum would display things. There's things that are sitting there that you can look at
mm-hmm.
that have maybe a little bit of a description, and that's it. That's right. It. They're sitting in a case. You can look at it, and they have a description. Maybe. Maybe they'll just have a title or something like that. And then that's it. I mean, if it's an exhibit full of other things of that type, they might not even have much description at all. It's just, here's a thing. Take a look at it, right? One of the biggest museums I've ever been in that was just like, this is all that was, and it's supposed to be one of the fanciest, nicest museums for archaeology in all of Europe, was the Archaeology Museum in Naples, Italy. And I was so unimpressed by that museum. And most of the artifacts in there are from Pompeii. And probably 70-80% of the displays are just like buttons and figurines and things mounted on these displays with numbers next to them. And there's no information whatsoever.
Oh.
No information about where it came from, about what it was used for. Some of the mosaics they had on the wall, they would actually have like, oh, this would have hung here, or this would have been placed here, or this would have been, you know, that was okay, but it was still on a wall in the museum. I mean, the only really cool thing in there was, aside from just like initially seeing those items, because they are unique items from that time period, which is really cool. The big like marble statues. I mean, they had 20, 30 foot tall marble statues in there that are just monumental, that came out of Pompeii and other places.
Right.
That are just in this museum now. And those are fantastic. You know, I mean, but those are cool in the way that seeing the airplanes in the Air and Space Museum are cool. Like, oh my God, that's you know,
really
that's
big, and it's right there.
It's right there. That's the Wright Flyer. That's the Spirit of St. Louis. You know, that's the actual plane. There's the Bell X-1. You know, I mean, that's really cool seeing that stuff. And from that standpoint, I thought that was really cool because I had never seen those things in the flesh. I already know the story, though. I already have the context.
Right. Well, that's the big part of museums, having the context. I used to bristle as a kid going to museums. When I was 11, I came down to visit family, my cousins who lived up in Arlington, and for a weekend. And I dragged my cousin, who doesn't live too far away, I dragged him into the Air and Space Museum 3 times in 2 days because I was such an aviation geek that I had to see all those airplanes. And but I had a lot of that context beforehand, which really makes a huge difference. But when I was a kid, you know, we'd go to an art museum someplace, and all that I could do was maybe appreciate the art aesthetically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a 10-year-old like me wasn't really all that interested in appreciating the art aesthetically. Right. I had no historical context for anything that I saw there. And, you know, most art museums don't have a whole lot of explanatory text like that.
Mm-hmm.
As an adult now, I'm actually much happier to go to a place that doesn't have a whole lot of explanatory text. I'll have the panels off to the side so that if I need to contextualize something in time or place or learn something about the artist or the culture or whatever, I can go off to the side and read it and jog my memory. Because more often than not, at this point in my life, it's a matter of like, it's something I'd forgotten about. And, you know, but I've got some context. And then I can go and I can appreciate the objects, the art, the whatever. Not necessarily on its own terms, but on terms that I can relate to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's something I've always struggled with, and we struggle with this a lot. I mean, I was telling you, my wife is a curator at the Metropolitan Museum, so we actually talk about museums and what museums should be doing all the time. And she's in the Department of Ancient Near Eastern Art, and that department is basically an art historical department,
right,
in the way that they've laid things out. They have a new director of their department as of a year ago, and she and my wife and one of the other senior curators there in her department have been working really hard to try to reimagine this. They're like, we're in an art museum. How do we reconceive of how we display things so that we're not trying to force the history down everybody's throat,
right,
but somebody with a little bit of history can come in and understand the objects, but the objects can shine not as examples of a particular time period, but as the object itself,
right,
and maybe, you know, representative of the culture that made it. You know, these are so old, we don't know the artists that made them.
Right.
You know, but that's a tricky question, and it also gets into then some of the problems that, you know, we were having this conversation earlier about glorifying the object and what that does, especially with cultural and archaeological materials, in terms of, you know, basically giving some sort of impetus to the art market and the looting of these things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you definitely had some very strong opinions about this. I'm not sure I'm entirely in line with them because I like stuff without too much explanatory text and I want to see the objects.
Right.
But, you know, there are pros and cons here, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, that's the... I gotta check my notifications here, make sure my wife can find us. make sure she's not doing that. Okay. Anyway, that's the, you know, the thing with the context. I mean, I'm such a, admittedly, I'm a context Nazi. I mean, when I'm thinking of even like an art museum where you're talking about like old world art or what's the time period she works in?
She's ancient Near Eastern. Basically it's the Middle East up to the time of Islam.
Now see that to me even, I mean that's, sure it's ancient Near Eastern art, but it's archaeology.
Yes,
right.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's an archaeology museum right there, that wing
which
anyway.
Which is why it's, and in our field, the divisions between art history, archaeology, philology
right.
are really blurry.
Right.
That we all kind of dip our toes into each other's fields. We all rely upon each other. We all read the same journals mm-hmm. and such. Yeah, okay, the Assyriologists are insane, and it's really hard to read their stuff. You need to know a lot about Semitic and other languages to, in order to get anything out of it.
Right.
But even then, they're looking at inscriptions that are on materials that were uncovered archaeologically.
Yeah.
And so if we expect to find inscriptions and we're going into the field in Iraq or Turkey or Syria or someplace, you'd bring somebody along the project that can read the materials. Mm-hmm. And that'll definitely inform how you dig and where you dig and why you dig and what you preserve and how you interpret everything. So it's an integral part of what we do. And those philologists are part of the dig project. You know?
And I think that's one thing I'd like to see in museum exhibits, though, is placing you in the situation, whether that placing you in the context, to go back to that word, whether that context is where the, you know, the time period and the place where the thing was originally used or appreciated, or the context in which it was found. In some cases, that seems more appropriate when we don't know a lot, maybe, about the people or the history. Because, at the Air and Space Museum, which we were at this morning, and at the American Museum of Natural History, we only went through a small part of it so far, but in the Human Origins exhibit, we got to a point where they were talking about like the Neanderthal bone flute and things like that were mm-hmm. found. And I didn't even realize it at first because it was so just like part of being there. There was a flute looping and playing in the background, and it wasn't obvious where it was coming from. It was just in there, and it was just playing in the background. And actually, almost when I first heard it, I was like, who's playing the flute? And then I realized it's actually part of this exhibit, and you don't even realize it. And as you're moving through the exhibit, there weren't a lot of sounds like that because I guess there was like a fire sound, you know, at one of the fire things.
Uh-huh.
But little things like that, I like to see stuff that actually tries to place you in the time period. And if I were trying to think, like if I were having a conversation with your wife or somebody like that, from my standpoint, somebody who doesn't actually know, admittedly, a whole lot about art completely, you know, like I know nothing about art history and, you know, appreciating art like that. I've never taken any classes. So when I'm standing there looking at it, I would appreciate a little more context as to when this painting or sculpture or thing was created. I would like to say, you know, what do we know about that time period, and can we reproduce some of the sounds? The original people that would have been appreciating this, would this have been in somebody's house? Would it have been outside? Were people looking at it? Can we have some sounds or even some smell? Maybe not smells if we're talking ancient.
Yeah,
areas.
No, probably not smells.
Not smells. We don't want to drive people away.
Well,
but
maybe a campfire smell.
Camp or food cooking smells. That wouldn't
be
too bad. They'll lead people into the cafeteria, see?
There was an exhibit, I can't remember the artist, a couple years ago in New York we went to, and it was an Assyrian town. And the end of the exhibit, you're just in a dark room with the sounds around you. The artist worked in sound.
That's awesome.
And that was really cool, a great experience. But, you know, there wasn't much pedagogical material there. It was an art museum.
Right.
But you get through, and in the end, it's this very experiential, visceral sort of thing that you're mm-hmm. standing in this darkened room, maybe with your eyes closed, doesn't matter, listening.
Yeah.
And there are different sounds of like instruments that are reproductions of ancient instruments, and you know the sounds of a town mm-hmm. around you, which was an interesting way of trying to present an experience, basically. I thought that was really effective.
Well, and in that case, the sounds were, to that artist, the thing that was being studied and appreciated.
Absolutely.
And if we could marry those two up with the visuals as well, man, that would be so amazing, you know? And I love it when it's subtle like that, like when they did the flute in this museum. It's just, I almost didn't even notice it was there.
Well, the subtlety, that's interesting. And that is a problem that a lot of people have. I have to some extent too, is that when you throw too many whiz-bang things into an exhibition, you lose sight of the primary reason for being there.
Right.
You know, so, and especially since we all have our tablets and our computers and such, now you can deploy that across the internet and you can get your ancillary information, you know, someplace else. So there's got to be a good reason for why you're in that gallery at the time looking at these objects, or reading about them on the text panels, or listening to the sounds that pertain to them. You know, there's got to be something that brings you right in there. So I think that there's another balancing act there that has to be done between trying to bring in some flash to make it more interesting of an experience and actually losing sight of why you're doing that. And I have something very specific about that, is that every year in the fifth grade at the Dalton School where I work, the students have a very long Mesopotamian curriculum. And at the end of it, we take them down to the University of Pennsylvania Museum so that they can see objects from the excavations at Ur.
Nice.
And there's a panel on the wall there that highlights work that I did looking at the, going back to the original excavation records and trying to reconstruct some of the stratigraphy and the locations of the tombs in space. And one of the things I found in that study was that some of the tombs aren't what, they're not arrayed the way that the Woolley, the excavator, thought. You know, so the sequence of them is inverted. He's lumped a couple of them together wrong. You know, so I argued that in my MA paper. But I used to go down there. I'd chaperone them, and we'd go into the exhibits, and we'd split the kids up into different groups, and some would go with one teacher, and some would, and they'd cycle through us to get different explanations, and they'd get to me, and I'd tell them this little story about what I was doing. The point of it was that Woolley excavated, you know, for the time very carefully, and recorded for the time very well, and because of that recording, it allowed me 70 years later to go back and reanalyze, and that's the strength of it, and that's the story I wanted to tell, and that's why I wanted to tell the kids there. And there's this panel, and then I stopped doing that because I thought, well, this is stupid. I could tell them this story anywhere.
Right.
You know, I don't have to do that right here. It, you know, a couple of them might be mildly impressed that my name is on that panel. But aside from that, there's nothing that's drawing them to that other than me taking and directing their attention directly to it. And so since then, I've been, every time we go down there, when I take the part, I go right past my panel with my name. I say, yep, that's my work. And don't go into it at all, because right behind there is the ramen in the thicket. I mean, directly opposite, 3 feet away from it. And that's a much more important thing to have the kids look at and discuss and analyze. And, you know, that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so, that's true. You know, sometimes we try to want to, I don't want to say bring too much science into it, and kind of lose a little bit of the humanity behind it. But some exhibits can tend to do that, I think, when they try to bring a little too much into it. And instead of letting people just, because I get what you're saying, you're more of a fan of letting people just experience, you know.
I think that the experience can definitely be highlighted, and it also depends on the kind of museum. I mean, going to see a going into a simulator, a flight simulator at the Air and Space Museum, is absolutely contextually sensible, right?
Yeah.
You know, it is, yes, a little bit like going on a ride. And so there are going to be people, and I know that when I was 11, that's what I wanted to do, and I didn't get the chance to, but it didn't matter so much. But, which is why I kept on going back.
Right.
But you know, a fully immersive thing like that doesn't directly pertain to the objects might not be appropriate at the Met. That's what my wife's working on, is trying to re-envision how they foreground the art and suppress a little bit the history in what they're trying to say about the objects on display. And you were talking about context, and a lot of the objects that they have there were, you know, art pieces from 100 years ago, and so there is no meaningful context. You know, there's a trading history of the object, and there are guesses as to where it came from. educated mm-hmm. guesses, but not necessarily anything that you could remotely call archaeological context. Mm. They do have other ones that do have quite good context because they came from excavations, mm-hmm. and they know that, and they want to put that, so they don't want to submerge that. They want to be totally upfront about what's known and what's not known and how things are known and why things aren't known. But again, they have to do it with sensitivity because the focus of their exhibition really should be the art and the artistry in the objects that they wanted to display, not the not necessarily the history lesson to go along with that. If you get the history lesson from it, that's an extra bonus.
Right. And I guess that's... I guess that's where I try to have trouble separating the archaeologist in me from just a person appreciating things like that. Because mm-hmm. when I look at art, like I said, if someone was playing something, you know, was displaying a piece of art from, say, the 1700s, and they're playing, like, you know, harpsichord music in the background or something, you know,
that
something
might
where
be effective.
It might be effective. But then again, somebody who's, you know, really into art interpretation, and this is a really important piece or something like that, might be just saying, listen, this is timeless, and we want you to interpret it based on now, not based on 300 years ago, mm-hmm. or based on, you know, you as a person and your experiences, not on... Because I'm interested more in the motivations of the artist and what was the artist experiencing at that time uh-huh. in that place to cause them to create such a thing. That's the thing that really interests me. Well, to bring it back to where we're sitting right now, you know, what are some of the things, what are some of the things you've seen in museums? We'll start with the bad, and then we'll go to the good, that you've seen that have just been like, man, I just really would have done this a different way.
You know, I haven't seen anything today that was bad.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely, like I've said, you know, where you have video displays to give ancillary information, and you see this with kids at museums all the time. They go and they sit down at the desk there in the corner, and they start playing it like it's a video game,
mm-hmm.
And drilling through all the, you know, hopefully they're learning something, but more often than not, I get the feeling like they're just pushing buttons because it's a display and they're conditioned to do so, and then ignoring everything else that's going on around them. And that's certainly a problem that we have when we take those fifth graders there. There is mm-hmm. one display in the corner, and as we get close to that, inevitably, three of the 11 kids that are in my group will go right to that and start pressing buttons.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there's good material there, but that material can be deployed across the internet. It's not a bad thing that it's there, but it can be a problematic thing that it's there. You know, if your intention is to show them the actual objects that they've been studying for months.
Well, and I don't personally know any science museum curators. I'd like to talk to one because a lot of the science-based museums, you know, they always have, and by science, I even mean like archaeology, history, things like that.
Uh-huh.
They always have some sort of interactive displays that are really geared towards children, you know, for the most part. Now, I was surprised at natural history in here in the human origins exhibit. They do have, they're at child height, so everybody can do it, and probably so, like, they're wheelchair accessible and things like that, but they had displays that were clearly not just for children. Like, you move these things across, and they're interactive in the sense that you have to actually touch something on the display to see what's the cost and benefit of humans standing upright, for example, is one of them, you know, something like that. And so in that sense, I feel like these curators and the people who are, and the museum display people that are setting these up, are calling it a win if they get some sort of interaction rather than somebody just walking by and glossing
over
it.
That comes down to the kind of museum. You know, that's definitely more applicable in a science museum.
Right.
And it gets into bits of pedagogy, mm-hmm. where you have, for example, the notion that if you're manipulating something, if you're working with something at the same time, you retain that knowledge more. You get it more viscerally. You understand it in a different way than you would if you're just reading about it. And that works for a lot of people for a lot of different kinds of things. So if you're trying to show how something works physically, for example, at a science museum, and you can do an interactive exhibit that demonstrates that, that can really help drive the point home. And yeah, so a certain number of kids are going to be doing and playing the whatever game as if it's a game, but mm-hmm. some aren't, and some of those that do play with it as a game are still going to get the important underlying concepts.
Right. Hopefully.
But that's also because, you know, most science museums, the object itself isn't really the focus. It's the principle behind it. The mm-hmm. object is an illustration of. And we're in an art museum, it's the inverse,
right?
The object is the focus, and whatever you want to tell, the story is background information.
Right, right. Yeah, and that's a good point to note, that it is the type of museum that really matters. And that's, it's also, I think, the location of the museum.
This network is supported by our listeners. You can become a supporting member by going to arcpodnet.com/members and signing up. As a supporting member, you have access to high-quality downloads of each show and a discount at our future online store and access to show hosts on a members-only Slack team. For professional members, we'll have training shows and other special content offered throughout the year. Once again, go to arcpodnet.com/members to support the network and get some great extras and swag in the process. That's arcpodnet.com/members.
Like, here in the National Mall, amongst all the national museums, the Smithsonian museums, I kind of would expect this to just be a repository for things that are important to the country, the history of the country.
Yeah, well, that's really what...
that's what this is.
This whole thing. Yeah. I mean, if you look at it, I look at it not unlike, you know, Chaco Canyon or something, where you have all
really
these...
is, right?
You know, you spend the whole day walking from one end to the other. It's this big canyon that cuts between the Jefferson Memorial and the Capitol, and we've got...
Man, this is
walls
exactly
on either side here, and these walls, in our case, happen to be these museums that are telling different parts of what people have decided are the American story.
This is exactly like Chaco Canyon. We did an 8-mile hike just to go see one pueblo, and it was. I mean, that's what you do, but that's what we do here.
Yeah.
We've gone from end to end to see different things,
right.
You know, in our monuments, in our
right.
American monuments. But yeah, that's how I see these museums here. I see them more as almost less as teaching museums. Like, I don't want to like I appreciate it when I learn something, but I do see it as a repository for American history in one way or another.
Right.
You know, like that's why at the Air and Space Museum, there's all the airplanes hanging from the ceilings and all the
different
displays.
That's why you've got the Wright Flyer there.
The Wright Flyer, yeah, the Bell
X-1. Icon of American history and a major part of our national mythos as inventors and as scrappy and as smart and as...
Absolutely.
Originators
and
iconoclasts and all the above.
It's amazing. And it's amazing that we decide to keep stuff like that, too, and how fast technology is changing as well. Because, you know, you look at a lot of the stuff in there. I mean, I took a picture of, let's say, like I said, the Bell X-1, Chuck Yeager's, first plane, he broke the sound barrier.
Uh-huh.
Chuck Yeager is alive and lives not far from me in Northern California. And we've actually, there's people I know in Reno that know Chuck Yeager that have talked about getting him over to help speak for our Civil Air Patrol squadron.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Chuck freaking Yeager.
That's
and his
pretty cool.
plane that he broke the sound barrier and it's right there in the Smithsonian. And John Glenn, you know, his spacesuit is over there. Wait, did he just recently die? He's still alive, I think.
Oh.
Maybe it's Neil Armstrong that died.
No, Buzz Aldrin. No, he's still alive.
Well, either way, you know what? If he's not alive, it's not been very long that he's been dead.
Yeah.
But anyway, we decided let's take that and put it over there. And like that, an exhibit my wife thought she would be dragging me to, and she kind of was a little bit, but I'm still an archaeologist and a lover of history. But one of the first things we went to in the American History Museum was I keep saying that wrong, the American Museum of History?
The Museum of American History?
Museum of American History?
I don't know.
You know what I'm talking
about.
They're
all a jumble right now. Yeah, the one right there.
The one right there, yeah. But the First Lady dresses exhibit of American First Ladies. And that was actually pretty interesting. I could have seen a few different ways I would have liked to have seen that exhibit done personally. But I thought it was really interesting. And it's amazing to me to look at those and say, well, at least these last, like, handful of women are still alive, you
right.
know, and they just donated their, I mean, Michelle Obama's inaugural ball dress is in there. And
mm-hmm.
that was, you know, what, 10 years ago at this point, 9 years ago.
Yeah.
So, and actually, Melania Trump, it hasn't even been a year. Her dress is in there.
Right.
And on the center, I'm guessing whoever the current first lady is in like the center display.
Yeah, I would expect.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Well, I was just in there and it's so full of really interesting little bits of pop cultural ephemera. I went in there to go look at the Tucker car.
Yeah.
And I went there to see the old Telecaster guitar that they had. And
nice.
And on the way
I saw
walking
the Apple
II. I missed that, but I saw Mr. Rogers' sweater. And
oh,
I was pretty happy to see that.
That's pretty awesome. I don't remember seeing that. Damn it. Yeah.
It's right there next to Oscar the Grouch. So.
See, there's so much in there. Yeah.
But it's there was an Etch-a-Sketch on the wall.
I saw that one, yeah. Yeah. And that's really cool. That's one thing I appreciate about the museums down here is they're cataloging history before some of it even becomes history. Mm-hmm. Like they're really staying on top of things and recognizing.
That's what they do pretty aggressively there.
Yeah.
And the other ones range between, you know, very traditional art museums and natural history museum, which is a very good one, but it's like any other natural history museum you've been at. That you know what the layouts are going to be. The one that I started out today at is the American Indian Museum. And I went there specifically to go see the Inca Road exhibition.
Oh, wow.
Which was really, really well done.
Yeah.
It's not especially densely crowded. They start with a little bit of the antecedent cultures to the Inca, and then it's just a lot about the roads. I wish they'd gone into more tech about how the road itself is built, but they do have some details about how those, you know, wacky rope bridges are built, how they're put together, both in terms of like who does it and what the technology is to make those ropes and how far they can span and how much weight they can hold. And they talked about the technology of the terraced agriculture. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's a fairly big exhibition. Again, not very densely packed, but densely packed with information. And accessible in a lot of different modes of conveying that. They do have, you know, object behind glass with a little plaque, and they've got lots of text panels, and they've got a few manipulables. And what they had that was interesting, I'm still not sure how I feel about it, but I definitely played with it for a while. They had like a, I guess it must be a Microsoft Surface, a big 7x3 table.
I think it's called the Microsoft table, actually.
That's what it's called now?
I think so, yeah.
With a map of Cusco.
Oh, wow.
And with different highlighted areas on it. And
nice.
So you could press the button and it would come up, bilingual, Spanish and English, with other photos that you could go through. Some of them had 3D reconstructions. Some of them had 3D photographs that you could then scroll through to see what it would look like standing in that spot.
Mm-hmm.
Ancillary information, videos, again, both bilingual, English and Spanish. And that one, I think I'm okay with that.
No, that sounds really cool, and I like that. I appreciate that these museums have the money, actually, and the expertise. I mean, they're seen as like, you know, probably for museum curators, they're seen as like the place to eventually be at some point. I mean, they're the pinnacle of their categories, right?
Yeah. Well, what I liked about that table was that it contextualized it.
Yeah.
You know, there's a map of Cusco. Here's these pictures. Otherwise, these pictures would
be,
you wouldn't necessarily know where in the city they were and what they had to do.
Oh,
this is part of the processional way. This is the old temple. Here's the Spanish church that was put on top of it. Here, you know, and you could see it and start to fit these different images that you've seen, these different objects, these different ideas that you got through the whole rest of the exhibition into space relative to each other.
Right.
Which is why I think I'm okay with this this intrusion of high tech into the exhibition space there. It also wasn't crowded with people.
Right.
You know, so it didn't have 12 little kids pressing every button. And ignoring everything else there. People would walk through, they'd get to that, they'd spend a few minutes at it, go, and then walk on.
Nice. Well, you know that, again, I love that because it helps put you in the space, right? That map helps you show where things are. That archaeology museum in Naples, if they had put even a map of Pompeii or wherever these things were and say, this was here.
Yes.
You know, like this was found here. But they couldn't have done that because they grouped things in ways that made that impossible. Like I would see a display of, you know, 100 different cameos, you know, or something like that, or beads or little pieces of glass, or they were all in a case together.
Uh-huh.
So you couldn't say these were all found here because they were categorized by object, not by location or use or anything like that. So this leads to, let's wrap up this conversation with what we'd like to see in the future, because I've had a lot of conversations with people about museums of the future, and 99% of the time it ends up being some sort of, like if we talk way in the future, it ends up being some sort of immersive holographic 3D reconstruction that you can do from your house. Now, I think we know that things will eventually go there. So my question to you is more, is it important? Because you talk to people that are real purists or that don't understand technology or don't like technology, and they say, no, I think you should go to the museum. Is it more important to physically see the object or to understand the history and context of the object?
Oh, I think that I think that it's more important to understand the history and the context, but I think that the way our wiring is biologically, it's more important to see it, to make it real. And years ago, I was listening to NPR, and I heard what at the time I thought was the stupidest thing ever. And I really wish I could remember who said this. But he said, you know, people go to the Grand Canyon, and they take the family picture of them standing in the Grand Canyon. Yeah. Why do they do that? To prove that they were there. It's like, no, that's not why. It's to prove that the Grand Canyon exists. They know that they're real, but now they have proof that the Grand Canyon isn't really as big and spectacular as it is.
Yeah.
And I've come around to thinking that this is actually a really brilliant idea, that people do want to see originals of things because then it exists in a way that they can comprehend and then turn around and learn more about. So, I think that it's tough. The important thing is the knowledge and the information, but seeing something really drives it home in a good way. And I'm going to give you another example of a museum that we were at, not here. This is in Bolzano, Italy. It's the Itzi the Iceman Museum.
Oh, yeah.
If you ever get the chance to go to that museum, brilliant archaeological museum. Small, wonderfully laid out, draws you right through with various examples and such. You get to see Itzi himself through glass. Descriptions about the objects that were on him, how they were made, how they were used. There might be some other examples. And then it ends up with things, stories of and things from other people who in more recent times who've gone missing in the Alps.
Right.
And so you come out of that understanding a lot about Bronze Age Alpine Europe, understanding a hell of a lot about Itzi and what's the current thought about his life, his death, and what's understood about his discovery, and contextualize, about the dangers of the Alps, because, that part of the Alps is really, really snowy, icy, and people do get lost there and people do die there.
Right.
Even if they are not chased through the Alps and shot with arrows.
Nice. Side note, go to arcpodnet.com and type in Iceman in the search bar, and you'll find the Arc 365 episode that we did about Itzi the Iceman.
Oh, good.
It was a very short one, but it was very cool. Yeah. It's nice doing a little bit of research on that, because I'd heard of him, obviously, but hadn't really delved into it a little bit. I guess the way I see it is I agree with you, and I agree with people that think that, it is important to make the objects real. I mean, it was, but then again, maybe it's just me. I'm so jaded sometimes. Like, I'm looking at everything in the Air and Space Museum going, is that real? Is that actually it? Like, I was actually surprised at, like, the American Museum, we'll just call it that, the American Museum of History and Other Things, that when we saw the Star Spangled, like, they weren't even really highlighting it that much, I don't feel. But when you walk into the place, if you walk in from the right entrance, you see the big metal conceptual American flag sitting right there on the wall, right? And then you go behind it. We almost didn't even go through that little exhibit. I was like, oh, it's just an exhibit on the flag. And I was like, okay, I was in the military. I'm in the Civil Air Patrol now. I know all about the flag and the history and things like that. But we're like, no, let's go through it. And you go through there, and you come around the backside, and it's the goddamn original flag that hung over Baltimore.
Right.
And I had no idea that was back there.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is somebody here's telling you about context. It was so amazing just being near that flag and seeing it and knowing that that was the original flag that hung over there that inspired the song and all that stuff. That was kind of cool. On the other hand, there's so much stuff in the museums that are reproductions, that are, like in this Human Origins Museum, nothing in there was real.
Right.
They're all casts.
Right.
Right? Because the original fossils, the Africans are smart enough, whether they're Kenyan, Ethiopian, Tanzanian, they're keeping that shit now. Like, it's not leaving. Like, we saw Lucy when it was on tour in the United States. We saw her when we were happening driving through Houston, and we saw the Lucy exhibit. We got to see the real Australopithecus afarensis, skeleton laying out there. And it was, there's this whole thing leading up to it, and then it was this darkened room, and she's laid out right there. And it was pretty cool seeing the actual fossils. But I guess my point is, in a lot of museums, how much stuff are you looking at, the really important things, in a lot now in the Air and Space Museum, those are real. Like those are the actual aircraft, you know, that are hanging from the ceiling, which I think is still kind of amazing.
In some cases, heavily reconstructed.
Even the Wright Flyer had been refabricated just not too long ago.
And in some cases, cut up so they can fit, you know, the nose cone in.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
The rest of it is who knows where.
I know, exactly. So in that sense, it's neat being there and seeing the actual things, but how much of that stuff is real, and why do we place so much importance on that? I feel like that's why we own storage units. You know what I mean? Like we put such a heavy emphasis on things and owning and visual, but I understand having to have the reality of knowing that it actually exists too. You know, it's like that guy, that flat earth guy whose mission in the rocket that he built in his backyard to fly up above.
Yeah, to go all 1,800 feet in the air.
To somehow prove that he could have just climbed a mountain. He's in the desert, right? A mountain and you're done, buddy. But the government shut him down because he was going to kill himself or someone else doing it.
Yeah.
But he needed visual proof to see that the Earth was flat. And we're such a visual species, you know, and this is why museums continue to exist and thrive, I think.
No, I agree with that. I mean, it's... Again, there are a lot of interesting questions, and I'm not a museologist, so, you know.
You might be partially getting to talk to your wife about it all the time.
Yeah, I a little bit by osmosis, and I'm not a fraction of what she is.
I'm not a knitter, but I know shockingly large amounts of information about it because of my wife.
You seem to be carrying around some knitting.
It was in my bag. as our segue posse goes by.
Yeah, those... You just can't look cool riding one.
I like seeing the people on the Segway with like dirt all over the front of their pants. You know they didn't do well in the training. So anyway, what would you like to see in a museum in 20 years? Like as a display or your experience with the objects, whether it's in the museum or not?
Well, I think that smart, and this is PAP, but
yeah.
I think being really smart about the ancillary materials, about whether they be static text panels, whether they be different kind of interactive or experiential sorts of enhancements, I think are all good and are all necessary, but the balance has to be there in any given exhibition. It's going to be entirely dependent on what kind of museum it is, what the story is that they're trying to tell, what the objects are that they have on hand. But I think that you have to be really sensitive, and you know, and good curators are really sensitive about striking the right balance between all that ancillary stuff so that you have the background knowledge to appreciate what you're seeing without crowding out what you're supposed to be appreciating.
Right. Yeah, that's, I don't know. I like the thought of, me personally, I like the thought of something like this existing in Washington, D.C., where we can take this history and these objects and we can curate them here, the actual real thing, so they can be here, they can be on display for people that want to make it here. But I'm 42 years old, and this is the first time I've been in the nation's capital. First time I've been in any of these museums. I was just about to say, I don't know when I'll be here next, but I'll be here in April for the Society for American Archaeology Conference because it's in the same damn hotel. I'm going to try to get the same Airbnb. It was only $11 Uber ride.
April, I'll swing back down, and we can record another session.
There you go.
Maybe there's some good new exhibition I should see.
I'm going to have a booth. Come to the conference, and we can record in the booth. I love that there's a physical repository for all these things. As far as regional, local museums go, I think they'd be better off, maybe having a housing place for some of these samples of their regional things so you know where the things came from and things like that. But I think they'd be better off putting up a more, as technology increases anyway, we can make this actually a good experience, making a more virtual experience and a virtual walkthrough and a virtual environment, you know, where you can experience that. But of course, the technology has to catch up with that. Until you open your junk drawer in your kitchen and it's full of 3D glasses and goggles, you know, like that you just hook to your TV, like they're just a dime a dozen. You go down and get one out of the vending machine. Until that happens, we're not going to have something like that. And so we're talking way in the future. But I don't know. That's where I'd like to see things go because I think people would experience them a lot more. So, but without the real stuff behind it, you're going to have generations of people born going, did that stuff really happen? Because I just saw it in a video game. And then people are going to mess with it visually.
Well, especially as the graphics get better and more realistic.
Yeah. I know. where will the lines be between reality and
the virtual? Like when you go to an archaeological site that's had a lot of reconstruction, but the reconstruction hasn't been indicated.
Right, right.
You know, it'll be like generations of Europeans thinking that all the Greek and Roman statues were intended to be marble white as opposed to painted garish colors.
Yes.
You'll have a kind of skewed perspective on reality and where things are. So I think for that aspect, having real objects and real things to look at, to discuss, is still going to always be there. Being able to go and look at what I'm assuming is Mr. Rogers' real sweater.
Right, right.
As opposed to a reproduction. Probably wouldn't be that hard to reproduce.
Probably not. He probably bought his sweater at, like, you know, JCPenney or something. I mean, let's be honest. Sears, probably. That's a good point to end on, too, because it's something I hadn't really thought about, but you just kind of alluded to it. You know, museums do their own... They do, in their own way, show us a version of history that they want us to see.
Yeah, they become authorities for things. They're
right.
They're giving you an authoritative statement that this is real, this is what the experts believe you should understand this as.
Right. Right. You know, it brings up, like, why is there a Native American History Museum here? Why is there an African Society and Culture, I think it's called, museum, African American, you know, culture museum? Why do those things exist? Because more than likely, people weren't incredibly, I wouldn't say they're unhappy, but they weren't probably overly happy with how those cultures are displayed in the Museum of Natural History or in the American History Museum.
That's always been a real problematic thing of having Native American artifacts in particular in natural history museums as if they are
animals. Right, totally. Yeah, I completely agree with that. And so it makes sense that they have their own museum, but they're showing the version of history that they want you to see. You know, those museums are. Every museum does that. And they try to probably... I'd like to think that they try to give the majority viewpoint, you know. But do they do that? And do they cover all the bases? I don't know. I don't know if they do or not. But I don't know. Any final thoughts on museums?
I like them. I'm glad I came down today.
I like them too. And I'm so happy we went here and we saw all these things. And we saw these... monuments and all the things that we're surrounded by, the sheer amount of history. I've been to, we were talking about earlier, Rachel and I, you know, how many, we've been to different cities around the world, and, you know, we've been to places fairly recently too. We were in Italy last year and Scotland the year before that. And when I was in the Navy, I went to most of the countries in the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. And it was, I've been to a handful of, like, world capitals that are, like country capitals that are pretty well known, and 9 times out of 10, that capital is the place where people want to go anyway, like Rome. You know what I mean?
Right.
People want to go there, like London. People are going to these, Edinburgh in Scotland, and people go to these places. But the Washington D.C. to me is always seen as, even for me growing up on the West Coast, is always just like a center of politics, not a center of, you know, all these monuments and history and museums. I knew all this stuff was here. I've always known all this stuff was here, but. Really being able to see this on our soil, on American soil, is something I think everybody should do. I mean, just looking at the Capitol down the way there and some of these buildings here, I mean, you could lift right out here and drop down into, you know, downtown Naples or anywhere else with big monumental architecture and think, yeah, we got that too. You know, I mean, it's not quite the same.
No.
It's in different styles, but it's in our own style.
Right.
You know, and it's just, it's something that, I don't know, really impresses me about what we have here. And I'm glad I came too. So.
Good.
Yeah. Well, I think we'll call that good. And if you've got your own thoughts on museums, which I'm sure that
please
you do.
Please chime in. I'm sure we've got great ideas out there.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Corrections to things we've said. Different takes on things.
Absolutely. If you're hearing this on and you're on Facebook or something like that, share this out too so other people can, I want to hear other people's takes on it. Especially people, you know, whoever's listening to this podcast, chances are you're a fan of archaeology or you are an archaeologist or something like that. I want to hear opinions from people who aren't into this at all, who aren't archaeologists, you know. Share this with your family members so, you know, Grandma Joan can be like, I love museums because they remind me of when I was a kid. You know, I don't know what she's going to say, but, you know, what do they think? So let us know, and contact us in the show notes. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. you can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show was produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks, and in the meantime, keep learning, keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day. This show is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.